right, we're back in session. Our next case this morning is Carr versus Saul. I see Mr. Forbes and Mr. Hensley. So you may proceed, Mr. Forbes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name's Randall Forbes. I represent the disability claimant in this appeal. With me in the room is a new attorney to our office, Ann Young, just so that you know. As all of you are familiar, the standard of review is a substantial evidence standard. If substantial evidence supports the commissioner's decision, it should be affirmed. Part of the substantial evidence standard is that the decision must be logically coherent and be capable of being meaningfully reviewed. If it is not, or if the evidence doesn't support the commissioner's decision, then it should be reversed and remanded. In this case, where we are arguing that a specialist opinion should have been given controlling weight under, this is under Regulation 1527 as it existed at the time of the filing of this application. If you find that our argument is correct and that work preclusive limitations should govern, then the proper disposition would be an award of benefits.
Mr. Forbes, I presume you're referring to Dr. Cominati's statement that your client cannot sit, stand, or walk for any sustained period of time.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Is it clear that that was a medical opinion or just a clinical statement based on what was going on during the examination?
Well, it's clear in this sense, the ALJ thought it was an opinion because the ALJ analyzed it as such.
Take that out of it right now. I'd like to know what the actual medical, oops.
Okay.
Dropped my paper. The medical records, you read a lot of these medical records.
Right.
How is it best understood holistically?
The definition of medical opinion is found at 1527A1. And it says statements from acceptable medical sources that reflect judgments about the nature and severity of your impairments, including your symptoms, diagnosis, prognosis, and what you can do despite impairments. What I would suggest, especially in this particular medical report record, is that the identification of the sit, stand, and walk problems is a statement about symptoms. It's also a statement about function. Notice, and I say this just a little bit in jest, but it's a good it illustrates the point. Notice there are no facts in the what we would normally call the patient history section. There are no facts that have to do with whether she likes root beer floats, and the reason is they're totally not relevant. But what is relevant to where the treating specialist is going in this record is whether or not the pain and functional problems follow the medical understandings of what matches up with the MRI and what can be fixed by the surgery.
If I could maybe focus this a little bit more, because it seems to me this is the crux of the case. It's clear that this statement is not phrased in the form of a restriction, as we typically see in these cases when doctors say that, you know, my patient is restricted in the following ways, X, Y, Z. That's not how this medical record reads. Is this statement, as far as where it appears and how it appears and how it's phrased in the medical record, recitation of what the doctor is receiving as a matter of reporting from the patient? Or is it a statement of what he is seeing as a result of his clinical examination of the patient? Because the clinical measures don't support this.
Because the clinical measures would also be the MRI. I think the MRI does support that.
Is that what Dr. Cavanati found based on his reading of the MRI?
He arrives at the conclusion that she should continue pain management therapy or have a rather extensive surgery. And the and he goes, here's another way of phrasing the point. If she had no problems walking, sitting, or standing, and no pain that corresponded with the problem at that spinal level and where it would radiate, he would say that, and then he'd note the MRI had that said what it said, but he probably wouldn't have, the idea of going to surgery would not have been a factor. You don't go to surgery to alleviate pain when there's
Mr. Forbes,
no
let me ask the question getting at the same point in slightly a different way. Dr. Cavanati's letter, it seems, came on the 13th or 14th of November. The hearing, as you know, was on November 30th.
Right.
What is in the administrative record that was submitted before the hearing or by way of supplementation that shows Ms. Carr had experienced a downturn in her ability to walk, sit, stand, et cetera? In other words, what happened in late 2017? And separate and apart from Dr. Cavanati's letter, what does the record show?
I think she testified as to the ability to stand, walk, or sit in approximate 15 increments with problems. That's at the administrative record. Number 95 and 96, I believe. She had a long history of chronic back pain. She had an MRI in 2012, which showed a disc problem in the lower vertebrae.
So that sounds all kind of general to me. You know, there was one period there where she helped a family member load a U-Haul, and she was experiencing quite a bit of lower back pain after that. Was there any fall or injury or anything that caused this flare-up that you can point us to in the record at the end of 17?
I'm not positive that there is. I would have to go back and look at my statement of the facts. I will let you know, Your Honor, that I did not do the administrative hearing in this particular case.
One of the reasons I'm asking that is because in your blue brief at page 25, you suggest, well, hey, maybe there's a different onset date here. The onset date shouldn't be in early 16, it should be at the end of 17. And for you to suggest that, maybe I'm mistaken, it seems to me that maybe you had something in mind that, you know, she took a bad fall or was somehow hurt, and that led to what we see documented in that letter.
I believe I was just throwing in an alternative argument to show that, assuming there was no downturn whatsoever, the medical evidence as of Dr. Cavanati's report when he had the benefit of the MRI was at a level that was disabling. I'm not sure that. So that's just the fallback argument. When you look at the report combined with her testimony, combined with the rest of the objective history, it's not out of the ballpark to suggest it it had been that way since she stopped working on her, or around her onset date. So I, that's about the best answer I could give you, Justice Scudder, at this point.
All right, thank you. Your time has expired.
Mr. All right, thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Jay Hinesley, representing the appellee in this matter. Excuse me.
Mr. Hinesley, can you see on your screen how you appear to us?
Is it fuzzy?
Yes. It looks like there's a coating of oil on the lens.
Yeah. Is that any better?
No. The lens needs to be cleaned.
Okay.
Whatever you're cleaning, it isn't the lens.
Yeah, I apologize.
That's a little.
Let me try.
You know, this is something you should do before your time begins at oral argument.
I understand, Your Honor. Is this any better?
Yes.
A little bit.
Okay.
It's a
Thank
bit.
You. Your Honors, the basic question before the court is whether the evidence in this case compels a contrary conclusion to that of the administrative law judge. In other words, is Ms. Carr correct in arguing that Dr. Canavati's letter to Dr. Hess leads a reasonable fact finder to only one conclusion, that Ms. Carr was disabled? The administrative law judge reviewed Dr. Canavati's statement that Ms. Carr was unable to sit, stand, or walk for any sustained period of time and reasonably found it extreme in light of the normal findings on examination. Ms. Carr is unable to demonstrate that no reasonable fact finder could have reached this conclusion. In fact, as the administrative law judge noted, the evidence as a whole supported her residual functional capacity assessment for a reduced range of sedentary work. Referring to Mr. Forbes' argument just briefly, where he kind of half-heartedly mentioned the root beer float, I'm going to go on that as well. Ms. Carr didn't complain about root beer floats. She complained about it to, she complained to Dr. Canavati about an inability to sit, stand, or walk, problems with her sleeping, and other subjective complaints. And these were reiterated by Dr. Canavati in the letter. Supported by treatment notes, Ms. Carr's activities of daily living, function reports, and state agency opinions, the ALJ's residual functional capacity assessment was supported by substantial evidence.
Mr. Hinesley, do you know of anything in the record that, goes to the question I was asking Mr. Forbes earlier about some event that caused a meaningful downturn for Ms. Carr, an injury, a fall, etc.?
I'm not aware of any, Your Honor. The only thing that was significant towards the end of the record, of course, was the surgery, which occurred after the hearing and before, just shortly before the ALJ's decision. The difficulty with presuming a later onset date, and I mentioned this in my brief, is that the surgery, which was January 17 of 2018, it occurred less than 4 months before the ALJ's decision. Accordingly, Ms. Carr is unable to establish that she would have even met the threshold 12-month duration requirement. And in fact, the evidence does show that less than 1 month after the surgery, Ms. Carr demonstrated minimal point tenderness in the lumbosacral region with good and equal strength throughout her lower extremities, and she walked with a, quote, strong and steady gait. Also significant, Judge Scudder, is that just a few weeks after the surgery, Ms. Carr received a 30-pound weight restriction for the following 3 months, and this is actually three times the maximum amount that the ALJ ultimately found that Ms. Carr could lift and carry. So there are big problems with a later onset. The objective tests repeatedly demonstrated normal findings. Also supportive of the ALJ's assessment was Dr. Hess's observation just a few months before Dr. Canivati's letter, that Ms. Carr had a, quote, wide variability in her function compared to her written statements. And then finally, as was alluded to a bit, I believe by Judge Sykes, Ms. Carr's activities of daily living also refuted an inability to sit, stand, or walk, again, for any sustained period of time. There was evidence that in August of 2017, Ms. Carr visited with her son and had played pool with him. She actively participated throughout 2017 in substance abuse group therapy, as well as individual therapy for anxiety. And there was evidence that she got together with family at a restaurant on at least two occasions. Again, this just flies in the face of an inability to sit, stand, or walk for any sustained period of time.
Mr. Hensley, what about the argument, though, that, you know, something's going on here for Dr. Canivati to put on the table an option of spinal fusion surgery? So, you know, you can join issue with the sentence, and I think, you know, it's very unclear if the sentence is just recording her own description of what she was experiencing or if it reflects a finding. But the bottom line is that spinal fusion surgery was one of the options. So something's going on, right?
Absolutely. And the ALJ found the back impairment to be a severe impairment. And if you take a look at the residual functional capacity, it's restrictive. I mean, the administrative law judge limited her to just sedentary work, never climbing ladders, ropes, or scaffolds, occasionally climbing ramps and stairs, balance, stoop, kneel, crouch, and crawl.
The question I have really at the heart of this is, the ALJ knew that because of the timing of the opinion vis-a-vis the surgery, that the spinal fusion surgery had went forward, right? But we don't...
Yes.
A logical question to me is, spinal fusion surgery sounds like a big deal, not a little deal. You know, can she work after the surgery? Has anything materially changed? And that's a gap, is it not, in the analysis?
I don't think it is, because the evidence that the ALJ had in front of her, it didn't show any increase in limitations.
So your point is that she bears the burden throughout. If there was such a limitation, she should have put it in front of the ALJ?
Yes. Again, Ms. Carr has the burden of demonstrating that substantial evidence does not support the ALJ's decision. This has been repeatedly stated to be more than a scintilla of evidence, but less than a preponderance. The evidence has to compel a different conclusion. And Ms. Carr is relying, I would emphasize, on not only a single page out of the record, but one sentence. One sentence in a single page out of nearly 1,000 pages in an evidentiary record to try to refute the ALJ's well-reasoned analysis. She offers no argument that the overall evidence of record supports such an extreme limitation or even any greater limitation than that adopted by the administrative law judge. So for that reason, we would maintain that the administrative law judge's decision was supported by substantial evidence and should be upheld by this court.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Forbes. You had used all your time, so we'll take the case under advisement.